Please be warned that this program contains mature subject matter and explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
Kidnapping, I mean, that's, they talk about kidnapping between each other like it's nothing. Like having somebody in the closet is nothing to them.
A big part of this case was built on the development and cultivation of confidential informants.
My name is Steve Lair, Task Force Officer, ICE National Gang Unit. With me is Michael Wade, Dion Cooley.
Murder, if it's ordered, like Steven said to me one time, they tell me to do it, I'm going to go do it, and nobody's going to find out.
So you always want to make sure that your CI's identity is never disclosed, or that the ABT, in this particular case, doesn't know who your CI's are.
Pretty sure I said to them more than once, he knows, and he's going to kill me.
I'm calling James Sampsell. He is the Region 4 inside major for the Aryan Brotherhood.
If I was a snitch, he would torture me himself. He would kill me himself, and that he would spend hours torturing me first. I will be in fear my whole life.
You're listening to My Aryan Princess from the Dallas Morning News, written by Scott Farwell and edited by Mike Wilson and Leona Allen. I'm Christopher Wynn. If you haven't listened to the previous chapters, go back and start from the top to get the whole story. Chapter 4, Goldmine of Intel.
Crystal meth sells for $1,000 an ounce. Cut the drugs in half, the street price is $650. Into quarters, $350. Stephen Red Good recognized the money in that math, but he couldn't afford the buy-in. So he negotiated a deal with ABT Captain Rusty Duke, a crystal king in Dallas, to front him a half ounce for a payback price of $450. Carol Blevins, a confidential informant for Homeland Security Investigations, texted details of the deal to her handler, Steve Lair. The feds wanted Rusty, a prime target in the six-year investigation of the Aryan Brotherhood of Texas. They believed he moved major weight through North Texas. Good stuff, 80% pure, broken into ice blue-tinged shards and stashed with bundles of cash at drop houses. Red's pickup rattled up a ramp to Interstate 20 about noon that March day in 2012. A thunderstorm still hovered over Tyler after snapping power lines and flooding creeks overnight. His old Ford needed new wiper blades. Carol sat next to him, pecking on her cell phone. She texted 2758 Doughty Ferry Road, and soon after, five Texas state troopers pulled into position near the low-slung ranch house with an overgrown yard. "Who are you texting?" Red asked. Carol played it off with an eye roll. "My sister." They pulled in the driveway about 1:15 p.m. The drug deal seemed routine. Rusty took a double sandwich-sized Tupperware container and a scale out of a kitchen cabinet. He weighed out 2 quarter-ounce piles, one after the other, and slid them into clear plastic baggies. Red asked Carol to crotch the drugs when they got back in the truck. It's an ABT thing. Featherwoods stash drugs in their underwear because male cops can't search there. They turned east toward Tyler. The feds waited until Red crossed into Kaufman County before asking a Texas Highway Patrol officer to make the stop. East Texas juries, agents say, hand down stiffer sentences than those in Dallas County. As Red slowed to pull off the highway, a text appeared on Carol's phone. "You're getting pulled over. Just a normal traffic stop. Don't worry." Carol texted back, "It's on me." She didn't see Lair's reply until she got out of jail 30 days later. "Get it off of you." Under questioning, Carol surrendered the meth and told the trooper it belonged to Red, but he booked both of them into the Kaufman County Jail for possession. Soon after, a task force officer pulled Carol into an interview room. "Give us some time," he said. "We didn't expect the dope to be on you."
The ABT confidential informants, for example, a lot of them were hooked on methamphetamine. And you can't really be a confidential informant if you're using narcotics.
If I wasn't using and showing that I was doing drugs, they wouldn't have trusted me.
They're making their approach.
We went after all the generals. There were 5 generals within the ABT.
Just went through the back fence.
The stakes soared during the summer of 2012 as the investigation galloped into the home stretch, with key cases riding on Carroll's intel. Increasingly, prosecutors sensed an opportunity to pull off a landmark case. With luck and a single indictment, they might sever the head of a deadly street gang, perhaps for the first time in history. The U.S. attorney leading the case, David Karpel, planned to use the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, a law passed in 1970 to take out the mafia. To do it, he'd need to prove the Brotherhood was a crime family primarily motivated by money, not a gang organized around racist ideology. The RICO statute allows prosecutors to charge those who order and facilitate crimes, as well as those who commit them, exactly the type of evidence provided by Carroll. She sensed tension in Lair's voice. His standing rejoinder, "Hang in there," was replaced by the terse, "I don't want to hear your bullshit. No excuses." Agents needed Carroll on the inside. In the weeks before her arrest in Kaufman County, she had essentially taken over the job of three-waying mail. Little by little, her connection to powerful ABT officers grew, and her romantic interest in Red waned. 3 days after she got out of jail, Carroll ditched him and moved to Odessa, a city with a small but violent ABT cell. She persuaded a brother there to pay for her bus ticket. After he picked her up at the station, Carroll showed her appreciation in the back seat. Hours later, she bonded with an ABT captain, and that night, she worked her mojo on a major. "I felt like I had the place wired," she said, "pretty much from the moment I walked in." People called Carroll a bro-ho, but she continued to seduce, with and without sex. "Officers eat first, right?" she said one night, delivering a plate of food. "That's right," the ABT captain said, imperious but pleased. "I like you." She doted on the gang's patriarch, an aging heroin addict, and kept his house spotless. She connected gang members to Dallas drug dealers. She deferred during public discussions, but in private offered her ideas. 5 years of experience paid off. Carroll disarmed the brothers with her Featherwood training, impressed them with her connections, and deceived them with habitual lying she learned as an addict. Mentally, Carroll slipped in beside the gang's leaders. They got inside her head, too. "It was an honor to be theirs, to be one of them," Carroll said. "I'd never had more friends or been more close to people. In some ways, Odessa was the best part of my life." It was also her most productive period as a CI. She gained the trust of ABT General James Skits Samsel, her eventual mark, and learned to mitigate risks. Carroll was always aware that live video flickered on monitors inside the gang's clubhouse, and outdoor cameras swept a fenced yard. She knew brothers used handheld scanners to detect listening devices. But for all the gang's security and implied violence, its blood-in, blood-out oath, and God forgives, brothers don't, credo, Carroll exploited a simple oversight: text messages. She pecked out most intel a letter at a time, snatches of conversation that might implicate people in unsolved crimes, serial numbers on guns, combinations to safes. "No one ever looked at my phone," said Carroll, who memorized phone numbers for 8 federal agents. "But I was careful, and I was always nervous about it." One afternoon, luck and an old couch kept her alive. Carroll knew the ABT had bought a collection of stolen assault rifles, and her handlers wanted photos and serial numbers. She believed the guns were stashed in an ABT major's trailer. Carroll made him a heavy lunch and pretended to watch TV as his eyes sagged shut on the sofa. Minutes later, cat quiet, she gentled clothes aside in his dark closet, feeling in corners and across the carpeted floor. Nothing. She climbed on a stool and checked shelves. Nada. Cell phone in hand, Carroll wiggled halfway under his bed, using the screen for light. Then, on the other side of the wall, she heard the couch springs whimper, then groan. Heart thumping, she reverse low crawled out and dashed on tiptoes into the hallway, just as the bedroom door swung open.
Back in the day, we would get tattoos of our shield. If you didn't hold up, you didn't hold up when you got X back then, I'd come peel your patch off of you. So if you got it tattooed on you, you can imagine I'm gonna skin a chunk of your side.
Love and loyalty, in Carol's world, are often a means to an end. She felt a part of something meaningful in Odessa. Not the crime or compulsive violence, necessarily, but she relished her role in the cohesive and dysfunctional family. Besides, she is an addict and an opportunist, and the ABT moved a lot of dope that summer. Any attempt to understand Carol has to begin with her insatiable need for a high. She also embraced the gang's balkanized thinking on race. "I loved being needed and having a place and a purpose," she said recently. "I had something I believed in. I still kinda do. I still mostly do." Even so, Carol gave up the gang's every move. Each day, she'd peck out text messages and click twice. Once to send, the other to delete. An etch-a-sketch way of erasing the contradiction. The Brotherhood holds church the second Saturday of each month, a meeting more sinister than spiritual. Dues must be paid, usually 10% of crime profits. Discipline is administered, beatings for tardiness, disrespect, theft, and officers occasionally order underlings to carry out retribution-style hits. Carol became numb to the violence, a survival skill she learned earlier in her life as a Featherwood. She once lured a man to a warehouse in Dallas where brothers waited. He falsely claimed membership in the ABT and had its patch inked on his chest, a shield pierced by a Nordic dagger. Gang members tackled him, wrapped chains around his wrist, and pulled him off his feet. Then, with a switchblade, they cut the Brotherhood's prized tattoo off his chest. Carol remembers a mouse pad-sized chunk of flesh pulling free in pieces, oozing blood that turned into liquid sheets, and the way his body crumpled when it hit the floor. "I felt nothing," Carol said, "because I can't have anything going through my mind in those moments."
They trusted me. The guys in Odessa trusted me full out without any question. After this happened, they were, of course, everybody was questionable, but they trusted me. That's Skits and Outlaw. The guys in Odessa would have laid down a lot for me.
Years ago, an ABT general ordered a hit on James Skits Samsel because he had failed to kill another man. Gang assassins shot him in the face and left him for dead. But Skits was so high on meth, the story goes, he was able to crawl a mile through a desert to a highway, where he was rescued. Legend shrouds many ABT leaders, especially those like Skits, who rise to become generals. In his case, some of the myth seems to fit the man. His left cheek puckers without supporting bone, where the .45 round ripped through, and cobblestone skin flares around scar tissue collected along his jaw and down the neck. Skits never held much of a grudge about the shooting, understanding what he'd signed up for. In fact, he took pride in the survival story and the aura of invincibility it cast on him. He told Carol the grisly tale a dozen times, more. Skits wanted her, always had, so after his wife left him and started working for the feds, he called Carol. A few days later, she climbed into his red Chevy pickup in Garland. Agents followed them to an extended stay hotel in Fort Worth. They smoked meth most of 2 days. "There were some intimate moments," Carol said. "We slept in the same bed." ABT generals usually don't buy their own dope. Too risky. Skits scored 2 pounds at a time from the Mexican mafia and paid an extra $2,000 to have it delivered to Odessa. But when police took down his dealer, he had to find his own supply in Dallas. He turned the run into a regular booty call. Carol's phone rang on November 9th, 2012. "Did you see the news?" Skits asked, tears in his voice. "They arrested my whole family tonight." The feds had unsealed a sweeping RICO indictment in Houston, charging 34 members of the Brotherhood with murder, assault, robbery, and other crimes. "It was tense, because we really dropped a hammer on those guys," said Carpel, the Justice Department's lead attorney. "We were concerned about officer safety, and we were concerned about prosecutor safety." Fearing ABT retaliation, Assistant U.S. Attorney Jay Heilman eventually withdrew from the case. The feds charged every ABT general, except Skits. He knew he was going to jail. He just didn't know exactly when it was going to happen, Carroll said. On some level, he knew it was me, but I think he cared too much to do anything about it. We loved each other. At some point, agents say, most confidential informants experience a chip in their resolve, like taking a rock to the windshield. For some, the crack runs until it obstructs their view. For others, it's a minor distraction. In a melancholy moment, Carroll confided in Lair. You know, he's good to me, she said, voice painted with guilt. She noticed hardness in her handler's eyes. But you know I'm going to do it. Agents pushed, and Carroll delivered.
I'm pretty sure I said to them more than once, he knows, and he's going to kill me. I would overhear things, and I wasn't blind to exactly what was going on. I knew he was unstable and nervous. If I was a snitch, that he would torture me himself. He would kill me himself, and that he would spend hours torturing me first.
Using her intel, the DEA took down a major meth dealer in Odessa. Days later, agents pulled over a brother who'd packed a fake carburetor with drugs. Carroll was the common link. Skitz's eyes clouded when he took a call about the second bust on Christmas Eve in Midland. Suspicion coalesced around Carroll. Skitz, you know I didn't, he cut her off. Right now, I don't know what to believe. The feds paid Carroll $1,500 after the arrest. She spent Christmas morning at home with her parents, a knot in her stomach, exchanging text messages with Skitz and a federal agent in Odessa. Her worlds were about to collide. On one side, the ABT's distrust boiled. On the other, ambitious agents were one arrest away from running the table on the Brotherhood. Skitz asked Carroll to meet at a hotel on New Year's Eve, the night before he planned to leave for West Texas. She texted details to Lair, who quickly called back with a suggestion wrapped in a question. Do you think he'd take you back to Odessa? Carroll was way ahead of him. I already set it up, she said. We're leaving in the morning. What neither one knew was this. Skitz didn't invite Carroll to Odessa for companionship. He was deciding whether to kill her.
My Aryan Princess is written by Scott Farwell and edited by Mike Wilson and Leona Allen. To hear the remaining chapters of the story, visit dallasnews.com/ABT for direct downloads and links to our show and Apple Podcasts and other audio players. You'll also find exclusive DMN subscription offers at dallasnews.com/listen. Thanks for listening.